I'm Fathery.
This is Dave.
And this is Text Trek.
Engage.
Welcome back aboard the Starship Texas for the 286th installment of the Text Trek podcast, the home of Star Trek fandom from deep in the heart of Texas, where we take a deep look at Star Trek old and new. And tonight we are talking about Star Trek Discovery Season 5, Episode 7, Arriga, written by M. Raven Metzner and directed by John Dudkowski. And before we get started on this episode, I do need to do some quick housekeeping per tradition and give a big thank you and shout out to the lovely Text Trek Patreon supporters. Thank you so much, Starfleet Sohel, Cake is Eternal, Crazy Dutchie, Joanne Robertson, John Daw, Geek Filter, Quarkspar, Stephanie Durantes, Matthew Averett, Braxton, Chuck A., Joel Vallis, Benginium, Arthur Lamoureux, Wanda Valentine, and our anonymous supporters. We've been having a lot of watch parties to celebrate with our patrons lately. We have monthly watch parties, and here in May, we had weekly watch parties, because if you join the Patreon on the Bridge Crew level, you also get a watch party for your birthday. We have one coming up tomorrow. If you're watching us live on Friday night, May 10th, then tomorrow, May 11th, we're actually having a celebration of Starfleet Sohel's birthday. We're going to be watching Star Trek Generations with the Text Trek Patreon supporters. So you can join the Patreon as little as $2 a month. That'll get into those monthly watch parties, or right now they're weekly, because then on the 18th we got another one. We're doing Prodigy's Time Amok and TNG's Home Soil for Joel. And then on May 25th, we're going to have a lot of Lower Decks fun. We're going to have a double feature with the patrons, watching not just the first Crisis Point episode, but both Crisis Point episodes. And, speaking of May 25th and Star Trek Lower Decks, there is going to be a day-long event. We're doing a stream-a-thon that Aaron Harvey has been putting together along with some other Star Trek content creators. And we're basically trying to get as many people watching and posting about Lower Decks on Saturday, May 25th. We want to send a message to the higher-ups that there's an appetite for more with those characters. You know, give us a made-for-streaming movie, give us a new season on a different streaming platform, whatever it takes. But Mike McMahon and Alex Kurtzman both said that, you know, there's a possible future for those characters, so we need to show that there's an appetite in the fandom to receive that.
Trek's done it before, it can do it again, right?
Yeah, and Aaron also wanted to make this event dedicated to the memory of John Trimble, who was involved with the famous letter-writing campaign that got the original series its third season back in the 60s, so very much in the tradition of the Star Trek fandom.
Yeah, absolutely. What could be more Trekky?
Well, you know, there is some other news also going on recently. Speaking of the good traditions of the Star Trek fandom, it sounds like our fandom got the franchise recognized with the Peabody Award.
Right.
I didn't know that genre franchises would sometimes win awards or win Peabody Awards, but apparently that's a thing that happens.
Yeah, and like their little write-up was really, really quite nice.
Oh, yeah, they had a longer page that people can, I'll post the link to, but they were saying some kind things in their social media announcing the Peabody Award going to Star Trek.
Yeah, here's the brief summation. Any cultural critic or media scholar would tell you that Star Trek, as an enterprise, pun mildly intended, helped invent a model for fandom through its faithful following originating in the 60s. The original Star Trek television series broke new ground for its diverse cast and unapologetically progressive values, like exploration over colonialism and cooperation over violence. For its enduring dedication to storytelling that projects the best of humanity into the distant future, the Star Trek franchise is honored with the Peabody Institutional Award. Institutional award. So yeah, there, I guess a broader kind of, like, this is for the whole dang franchise.
The entire institution of Star Trek.
Yeah.
That's how Alex Kurtzman refers to it as institution.
And Rachel in the comments notes, she loved how the Peabody Award specifically called out the importance of the fandom in there.
I know y'all have all heard me say it 100 times, so I apologize for repeating myself, but I often say, you know, we're not a perfect fandom by any means, but I do believe with all my heart that Star Trek fans are the best fandom. At least that's been my admittedly anecdotal experience, but that it is leaps and bounds by far apparently clear the best in my book, and it sounds like other people are agree with me, and we're getting some recognition for it. But yeah, I think that is awesome. I'm glad Rachel pointed that out. That's a great point. The thing that made Star Trek unique is that the people it attracted.
Well, one of the many things that made it unique, but yeah, it's like it drew.
I guess the indication, the proof.
Right. It drew in people that wanted to believe in and embrace its vision. And yeah, we do it imperfectly, but you know that's part of the show too. You know, Kirk must have said it, you know, dozens of times, even in the original series. Flawed but aspiring is humanity's thing.
Yeah, I mean, Gene Roddenberry, a very flawed dude himself, but you know, it's something that he described about you know, Star Trek being about humanity, which I always say, you know, it's about humanity. But he also would describe humans as, you know, we're a unique creature. We're the only thing we know of that's one part God and one part animal. And to be human, you have to have your heads in the clouds and think of all these, you know, these big, great ideas. But you also have like your toes down in the muck, in the mud, and all the you know, the primal animal part of our human brain, too. That really is where humans exist. You know, we're kind of like that bridge there. So you know, humanity is flawed and so is Star Trek, but still pretty cool.
Yeah, that was a nice one. Unexpected. I don't think anybody was like, oh, I hope this is the week they get a Peabody.
Yeah, nice to get some good surprise news. A lot of the times surprise news is frightening, but sometimes it can be delightful. But yeah, there was no other major news. So Dave, I think we're ready to talk about Erica.
All right, blood debt time.
Yeah, I'm going to quickly recap it by reading the official synopsis and then expand on that with some spoilers just to refresh the events of the episode for everyone. But the official synopsis reads, with Maul and Locke in custody, the Federation is pulled into a diplomatic and ethical firestorm when the Brain demand they be handed over. Meanwhile, Booker looks for ways to help as Tilly, Adira, and Reno work to decipher the latest clue. So they basically figure out that the clue is a library card to the roaming library, but oh no, the Primarch of the Breen is also going to be on his way. Wherever the disco goes, he's following the discovery. He wants the progenitor tech. Maul is going to try to give it to him because Locke apparently dies, and she wants Locke back.
Yeah, we'll see how long that death holds. But, you know, they're already, they have dangled resurrection, and
yeah, that's clearly like Maul's objective is to bring back Locke, so.
Right. But that said, I'm not so sure it's going to just be like a happily ever after. I feel like there may be prices involved. You know, I don't think it's quite so cut and dried as just, oh yeah, he's going to come back. But yeah, we got a Locke and Maul episodes, so partially at least.
Yeah, largely Maul and Locke, largely Breen. I'd say this is more like the Breen episode. So
yeah, there you go.
This episode, it was about like, let's transition the primary antagonist is no longer Maul and Locke. The primary antagonist is Locke's Breen uncle.
Right, we have moved into endgame here, yeah. I think.
Yeah, as we go into the third act of the season, going into the final third with the last 3 of 10 episodes starting next week, so. And that is the thing, you know, in writing structure, when you go from the second act to the third act, that's when, like, you know, the stakes are the highest, the outlook looks the most grim, the heroes are the most compromised. So yeah, that's definitely the situation where we find ourselves in now. Dave, I think it's my turn to give the first opening statement, just the broad impressions on the episode before we get into the specifics. But I got a lot to say on this. I'll try to spit it out fast. But I was mixed on last week's episode. I think I liked last week's episode a bit more than Dave did, but it was the first episode of the season that didn't really connect with me, especially compared to the rest of the season, which I've loved. So I'm happy to say that wasn't the case again this week. at the end of this, I am dying to see what happens next. Just like I was, you know, I had like that same type of excitement that I left the first five episodes with. While watching this, I was also on the edge of my seat for a lot of it. I've talked a lot about being really invested in the Maul and Locke story because we honestly have no idea where it might go. You know, we kind of have a pretty good idea. Okay, Stamets is going to be okay at the end of the season. Michael's going to be okay at the end of the season. Tilly's going to go teach at the academy, and we're all very confident it's going to be a lead in a show on Paramount Plus. I have no idea what the hell will happen to Maul and Locke, though, and as this episode proves by going into some surprising places. But it's also super easy for me to like this because it has so much Star Trek staples that I particularly am a fan of. I love politics and Star Trek. The big DS9 fan in me ate up all of the big dealings with the Breen, and, you know, I love, like, the galacto-politics, and I wanted this is something, like, I wanted more in 32nd Century Discoveries to find out who are the other superpowers beyond the Federation, and give me that larger, big picture world building. So I love that I was getting all those things I was asking for. And the stuff with Tarina doing the negotiations, it kind of bothered me that it wasn't Saru. I'm like, we have not gotten much Saru this season. This really should be Saru doing his ambassador stuff. I understand Doug Jones was busy. He's promoting Hocus Pocus 2. But, you know, it worked out. The Tarina material was really good. I found all of her scenes insanely watchable. By the end, when Maul does say to the Primarch that, you know, she is going to let him in on the progenitor tech and try to get it, I was like, oh, wow, yeah. If all she cares about is, like, getting Locke back, then yeah, that's the move she's gonna make. And oh shit. Like, I actually said, like, a big, like, F-bomb out loud, I think, just sitting here watching it as my mind is, like, piecing it together, like, oh no, like Maul is going to do this. And I'm very, very eager to see what happens. I was actually so worried that this episode, I thought that at the death scene, when it fades to black, that was, oddly enough, around the 47-minute marker, but I thought, oh no, is this the actual end? Are they going to cut the episode off here, and I have to wait for the next episode to see what happens next? So I was relieved that they gave me, like, a little bit more after that, but I'm still dying to see episode 8, so, which is, you know, I'm sure where the writers want me to be, so, in a serialized story. But Dave, enough about me. I'll shut up. What about you?
I think I probably mentioned this a few times before. I feel like one of the first TOS reruns I saw as a kid was the Corbomite Maneuver. And I've always been a fan, probably because that was so important to me early on, and I imprinted on it, of, like, the big bluffs in Star Trek. Mm. You know, that Kirk-style bluff. And so that's what they try and pull on the Breen in this episode, or do pull on the Breen. And that was a big win for me. And I also liked the thematic of the whole confrontation going on in this episode. Like, how does a peaceful organization like the Federation handle a warlord who won't back down, who's right in your face, and who kind of overpowers you? And so that was also really cool. And it turns out it's really still really hard to do that even in the 32nd century. But the episode also ended up sort of tempering my expectations for the season finale, because for me, it started to veer into some of those Discovery Endgame tropes. I feel like Rune is kind of that somewhat slightly boring big bad that we've seen before in, oh, Leland or Osira even. I kind of liked Osira, but we've got a big ship in there, a big bad guy ship that could be part of a final pew-pew showdown. And I feel like I'm seeing the plot contrivances a little bit more pushing people into place. That, you know, it turns out they have an expert in book antiquities right there on the ship in Jet Reno. Or, oh, hey, the empath is right in the room when, Stamets needs him to do the Betazoid artifact thing. I definitely felt like Book pausing to solve that riddle when he knew Maul, who we've been told many times this season is the one person he's just really intent on connecting with. She's running loose. She could get killed at any moment or escape. And he's like, well, let me pause and do this riddle real quick. So stuff like that was bugging me. I liked lots of individual scenes. I do think Tarina in particular got to seeing her rise to the occasion. That was great. Seeing Jet Reno filling out her very lively backstory was a lot of fun. I even liked just seeing Maul kick some ass in the sick bay and remind us that, oh yeah, yeah, she's not just a sad story. She's also a badass courier who lives on the edge. but I was left after the end of this feeling a little bit deflated because I really wanted it to live up to the energy of that first half. And I feel like I've got some concerns now. they're kind of the normal Discovery concerns, you know, nothing, I don't think it's going to just faceplant, but I was feeling some of the contrivances this one.
Interesting. Let's get into the episode breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts off with a pretty big contrivance, I guess, with the Terran warp pod, which I wasn't sure if I should give this criticism to two episodes ago to Mirrors or give it to this episode, Erica, because I thought, like, okay, the Terran warp pod, it's like, that's kind of a really convenient thing that just came from the Mirror universe that we've never heard of before, but you needed an explanation of why these two people on a 23rd century ship could escape and outrun all these 32nd century ships. So they come up with, like, the Terran warp pod, but then I thought, like, oh, well, maybe they'll talk more about it whenever we see it again. And here we see it again, and they don't really, like, explain it anymore. It's like, oh, there was a Terran warp pod. Those things sure are fast, right? And yeah, that's all we get. So yeah, it felt very contrived to me.
You know, Father, if I was trying to give it the benefit of the doubt, the no prize, as they used to in Marvel, I'd say that on a Terran ship, the sort of, like, the captain's need to survive might mean that he's got a badass escape ship, and that's his, like, you know, his, like, personal get me the F out of here.
The no prize I pulled out of my ass was mm-hmm. that it's enhanced with some of that spore drive tech that Emperor Giorgio had harnessed in season one. And for some reason, like, that's why it was so souped up and could go so fast.
Yeah. But yeah, a little bit, you know, that's honestly one of those somewhat Discovery things. And it's also kind of sometimes just a general Trek thing to sometimes just drop a little like that in there without explaining it.
But Nan came back, and I saw that, and she's not, like, a particular favorite of mine, but I like whenever she shows up because it's, you know, good use of the universe instead of just creating some other, like, security operative. So I like seeing the familiar face. It also adds some tension. I thought it was, like, good continuity. Oh yeah, the last time we saw Nan on the show, her job was to make sure that Burnham wasn't too soft on Book, and now there's still, like, this tension between her and Book. So I like that they remembered that.
You know, I'm not a big Nan fan. I'm a Nan fan, I guess, of Nan.
You're a non-Nan fan.
Yes. But I sort of feel like the beats are usually the same when she shows up, which is they remind us that she's got she's a little more hard-edged than the rest of the Disco crew, but also that she can compromise a little bit and she's family. And I feel like they usually hit those same beats, you know, every time she shows up. But I did like the kind of the friction with Book and going on there. I appreciate them having some internal issues and a little bit of internal politicking like that.
And the little line of dialogue that she has a Romulan on her team, on her Federation security
team. Yeah, I noticed
to help
that.
With the dialogue.
Does that mean something in particular, or do we think that there's going to be anything more to that? Or,
well, I just thought that was good use of the universe when they were explaining the Romulan diary that she had translated.
Oh, right, right. I forgot the diary was Romulan. That's what it was.
Yeah, I just like the mentioning that you know, Starfleet Romulans.
Have they said anything about the Romulans in the 32nd century prior to that?
Yeah, we've seen a bunch of Romulans in the Kolat Malat and
okay,
anytime
yeah,
they go
yeah,
to
right.
the bar.
The Kuat Malat stuff tends to sort of blur between seasons for me, and veer into Picard as well, so I forget that sometimes.
Yeah, I was only in Picard and then season 4 and 3 of Discovery, I guess. But I guess I'd like the Kuat Malat to show up before the end of the show, I think. I thought it was kind of dumb that you have to house Maul and Locke together, but I love that they threw in a line to kind of try to explain it of, like, well, you know, it's actually more trouble to separate them, and Locke is it stresses him out if she's not nearby, so for his own health we need her.
I think because he was, like, kind of at death's door, I can excuse it in this one.
And Culber's a bit of a softy too, so you could see him kind of wanting
to go
easy on them.
And you know what else? I think for Discovery, at least, but maybe in general in the 32nd century, I imagine they treat prisoners a little bit better. but yes, also, you know, you could probably sedate her still, or stun her.
My big fear watching this was that they bring Maul and Locke onto the Discovery, and I thought, like, Oh, that's going to be dumb if they bring Ma and Locke onto the ship with, like, the clue, and then, like, Ma and Locke steal the clue. I was so scared they were going to steal, like, the Betazoid card and then leave the Discovery, and it would make the Starfleet look really dumb. So I was glad that that didn't happen. But instead, they bring everyone to Starfleet HQ, and Burnham meets with Vance, and we learn that the Primarch is on his way. He's coming to the HQ. And I really liked Burnham's idea here of, instead of just running all over the galaxy, they're going to stay here and force the Breen to deal with them, because that's what it would eventually come to. But I don't know, what did you think of that decision?
You know, I was sort of torn on it. I was like, honestly, watching Oded Fehr, I thought he did such a good job of showing how anxiety-ridden Vance was about this. And he's like, yeah. Okay. But then I was like, this feels like one of those sort of Burnham plays that's like too risky if you don't have a damn good plan. But, admittedly, there is something to be said for, well, she knows the Vulcan hello as a concept. Although I guess it didn't work out great for her. But, I was thinking, I don't know, I feel like Burnham's making a mistake. But then I sort of started to kind of come around to her side on it. I think that's a pretty solid bit of drama. I don't have to agree with her every decision to kind of find it, that there's a sound logic behind it.
And also, otherwise, if she was just playing, I'm going to jump to this side of the galaxy, wait for the Breen to come over here, and I'm going to jump to this side of the galaxy, wait for them to come over. If she was doing that, then they would never be able to go find the progenitor tech. So I think she also is probably thinking of, like, the larger mission with that also.
Right. And she made a good point about, like, the hunt for them could leave a lot of carnage in its wake. In the comments, Joel mentions that they talked about being able to track Discovery, and he's just wondering how, if they can jump to the other side of the galaxy, how is that possible? And I don't know on that one. I understand the idea of tracking, like, warp markers and stuff like that.
We don't know, but a couple of episodes ago, they mentioned, they can trace our jump signature. So 32nd century Breen can whatever energy is dispersed when the Discovery uses the spore drive, the Breen can see it. They'll know where you jump to.
They have a spore drive visor on their ships, and they can just see that shit.
I think they probably just detect that that energy burst or whatever. But
yeah, I don't think that's completely insane. And in some ways, the Discovery has always been what you'd call in a video game overpowered. It's OP in the sense that it can just blink wherever they need. I don't mind that occasionally there's a limitation on it, like, these guys who are making out to be the baddest of the bad, and they're specifically very mercenary, tracker-type people, it makes sense they could probably track that.
I really liked the speechifying scenes that we've gotten with President Rilik in the past, and largely in season 4. I think she would have been really good to deal with the Breen, but I liked that she was at Teller Prime and that it was Tarina that had to do this, because it did kind of add to the danger, to the tension of, like, okay, the United Federation president can't be here. This is way too dangerous for her. Maybe the Navarre president can stick around, but not the big one, not the big lady. I do think that this could have been, like, Saru's chance to shine as diplomat, but I'm so worried about Maul at the end. I'm kind of glad it's Tarina who's the one who introduces that plan. But this, I guess, this is where like Tarina kind of starts shining as kind of the biggest diplomatic badass in the room when she's talking tough to Rayner. And I liked the sparks between her and Rayner.
Yeah, she had brought a lot of quiet power to the room. I forget the exact line, but she said, "Don't mistake, thoughtfulness for lack of nerve," or something like that.
Yeah,
she brought some big energy to that room, which is pretty cool, because she's not a person you think, oh, this is the one. Like, if you said Sisko was going to stand up to these guys, okay, yeah, I get that. She seems, she's got that more pacifistic vibe, and I'm like, oh, he's just gonna walk up and, like, punch her or something like that. But yeah, I thought they did a pretty good job on it.
I like Rayner a lot. I like his characterization. I like his backstory, but it does feel a little Star Trek cliche of just, like, okay, the Breen killed the people he cared about, and now he's he is to the Breen what Shaw was to the Borg. or what Kirk was to the Klingons, or what Picard was to the Borg, or what Michael was to the Klingons. I guess it's normally either Borg or Klingons, but sometimes it can be Breen. In the 32nd century, it's Breen.
So. Yeah, that's about right. I was thinking about this, and I do. It did bug me. They've ruined him, but just like, I wish they had another plot beat in there or something.
Like, this is fine, but if it had been something that was also interesting, but we hadn't seen a bunch of times before, that would have been much better.
Yeah. The way that this does feel sort of realistic to me is in, you know, as a thematic in kind of saying, well, this is what war does. It gives you institutionalized paranoia and fear and you know, that's the same in any given time period. So whatever the big threat is, chances are there's going to be some people who are dealing with PTSD from them. And in this case, they've made out that the Breen is one of those.
I did like his apology to Burnham, or his, I don't know, maybe it's like a half apology. And he's like, I apologize for my tone. But I think that's just funny because I find myself saying that a lot I stand by like what I said. Like, I'm sorry if the way I said it to you hurt your feelings, but I'm not going to take that back.
He said something like that early on when, I don't know if it was in the very episode or like that she made him her first officer or the next one, but he did say something like that early on. He's like, I went too far. You know, I stepped over the line there. My bad. But yeah, he's not usually one to apologize for the sentiment. I there was a part of me that was disappointed to see him kind of fall back after I'd seen some growth in the last several episodes. But Father, we were just talking off mic a few hours ago, not related to this actually, but talking about how people can be in real life. They don't have smooth character arcs. You're sometimes inconsistent or hypocritical about something. And it's him backpedaling a little bit. That makes sense. This is, you know, it's maybe not my favorite plot point that he has that tragedy, but if that is built into him, it makes sense that this would be the thing that makes him do it.
Yeah, and Burnham even points out at some point, like, oh yeah, this is probably a hard day for you dealing with all this Breen stuff. But when Michael goes to talk to Maul and Locke in sickbay, I liked the cool, like, I don't know, they do what they did to Arnold Schwarzenegger in Batman and Robin when he's in Arkham Asylum, right? And it's like, you can lay here on the bed in like the little cool zone and you can't leave this area.
Well, I don't hear too many references to Batman and Robin.
That just came to me right now as I was trying to think of how do I describe what's going on in sickbay in the scene.
I'm here for it, Father. I think your discussion of the icy jail cell is good stuff. Yeah, no, I thought that was a neat idea. That
scene has two United States governors in it. Enough said.
Well, oh, that's right. It's one of the guards. The deal is?
Yeah, we don't have to explain it here. People can chase that rabbit if they want.
So they've got, Father, I'm curious to hear about, what's your general take? I thought that the Breen in this episode were a little cartoonish, and that Rune, again, he kind of reminded me of Saris in Galaxy Quest, who I like in Galaxy Quest, but I kind of want something a little deeper in Star Trek. But I did like the other bits and pieces that were getting filled in about, like, you know, kind of building on the lore with the cold, you know, and the cellular regeneration or whatever that helps promote. Like, there's little neat bits here and there.
And just tying, like, the cold tech into what we heard in Deep Space Nine, when it was like, right, you know, why do they need these refrigeration suits after all? It was kind of a mystery of why they used those.
They definitely also, you know, they made out their threat to be large. They, you know, they had that people like, you know, oh, here comes just the shadow of their giant ship. When Vance, being as nervous as he is clearly because, oh yeah, this ship is rolling up right next to Federation HQ and they've got a beef with us.
When they are in that sickbay scene, that is when Burnham learns, and when the audience learns, like, Locke is actually the next in line to the Emperor. They had never, like, quite spelled that out, but it sounds like that the Emperor was this Primarch's brother, and after he died, then his son, Locke, became heir. And Locke doesn't want to be emperor, but his Primarch uncle does. And so he's kind of, okay, if I can keep my nephew under my thumb, and he will secure the throne for me to sit upon.
Right.
And that's what really made me get interested in the stuff going on with him, is kind of the political side of it. I agree with you, he is a boring character, but I'm kind of okay with that, with him just being like, you know, he's Lord Zedd from Power Rangers or whatever. He's just like a stuntman standing there with a helmet on, you know. But that's fine. I don't really need him to be much of a character. I like you know, Maul and Locke are like the interesting, and Rainer, they're like the interesting like new characters of the season. But I think that's actually kind of a good way of like handling the Breen, because I don't want to get to know any of the, like, Locke. Okay, we're gonna get to know him, but I don't really want to get to know like too many individual Breens too well. I want them to maintain their mystique and their alienness.
Yeah, there's definitely something to that. You know, people argue that the Borg got defanged when they, you know, when we started learning more about them, which is funny though, because like that's kind of like what Trek should be pursuing, taking something that's alien and explaining it and learning why it is what it is, so that you take away the fear. But dramatically, we want the fear and we want the mystery. I think that's an interesting kind of two different push pulls in fandom.
When Primarch Rune like shows up on their big holo projector, and you just have like this, you know, giant bad guy face, I actually like put in my notes watching this, like, this is just a saying I say a lot. I say this when I watch The Mandalorian and the other Star franchise, but yeah, sometimes it does feel like I'm watching big budget Power Rangers.
Because is it the hologram thing? Because I don't know Power Rangers.
I think it's just like people in helmets like that. Oh, and then like, okay. And then like you like, and it's not even like the real actor, and then like you dub in the dialogue later, and
their arms are kind of gesticulating, but right. But yeah, it's a
but you know,
voice.
I think the same thing when I'm watching like The Mandalorian, you know, so
right.
And it's like, well, I know that's not Katie Sackhoff talking to Pedro Pascal, but I'm just gonna sit here and pretend it is, I guess.
That's film magic, Father.
But yeah, I just like faceless bad guys, like you were saying, who like, something I pointed out in the episode Mirrors when we discussed it a couple weeks ago, is that, yeah, it is kind of lame for the character. But yeah, like, I don't think Rune's like an interesting character, but I think like the Breen as a concept and their kind of, you know, Game of Thronesian politics that they have going on internally, and the threat that they pose to the Federation is what I find more interesting.
I was like kind of on pins and needles when they make that gambit. And they bring up, I forget what the name of the other Primarch is. T'Halla? What was it? T'Hall, yeah. Because I was like, what if Rune just like talked to her like 2 days ago, or just like has some better intel on, you know, or what if she died like a year ago and it just hasn't made it outside the Breen circles? I was like, please work.
They never say for sure if that is a bluff. I kept wondering, like, did they actually like send a communication? I don't think they did. I think it is a bluff, but they never really confirm it one way or the other. But yeah, I mean, I'm assuming that it is.
I wondered about it briefly too, but I'm like, it has to be a bluff. There's no way they had time to do that.
Yeah, they all looked like pretty nervous. Like, is this guy gonna believe it?
Yeah, and I think that's why, you know, when Rainer does kind of come through in a clutch there with his, he kind of adds a little specificity to sort of seal the lie and at least introduce enough doubt in Rune's mind that he's like, oh, okay, maybe.
Maul and Locke escape sickbay. What do you think of that plan? I guess that Maul was Locke was going to OD and then tell Maul, go steal a shuttle and then beam me to it.
It's not what you call a great plan. But they're both, I think the deal with them is they're actually pretty good at improvisation. It's how they kept ahead of things. They've got good instincts for just like getting out of a room, and they can kind of, I think, work in tandem well when they're together. That's why they were such good couriers. So, you know, I actually, even though, you know, Locke says, or she's like, what does she say? What's the plan? And he's like, all I can say is you're not going to like it. Yeah, he's right. Theoretically, it like sort of works. She does get out. If he hadn't have accidentally like jammed a little too much juice into himself, then they might have been able to pull it off.
I thought it was like kind of dumb, but they've shown Maul and Locke do like these risky things like all season long, you know, like they jeopardized that village in the first episode to try to escape Starfleet. They put that time bug on Discovery. Like, who knows what kind of crazy stuff that would mess up, you know, if you start erasing the Discovery's events, the things that ship had done in the past, you know, that's pretty reckless to do.
Sure.
So I like that it kind of did finally come back to bite them in the ass. It felt kind of it's like, okay, y'all can't keep getting lucky with the stuff, you know, so.
Right. I think I almost wish they had made a point of mentioning what I just said, what like Rainer, because he has a profile on built up on them, that he had said, like, you know, they take big risks, but their, you know, their skill and their improvisation in the moment are such that they can usually pull it off. You know, I wish they just like literally just spelled it out like that, because that's kind of like that's their power. They take big risks and then they've got enough skill to push it through.
I'm sorry, but it's like that scene that introduces them when Maul is like, do you want to settle for pebbles or do you want the whole mountain? It's like, oh, yeah, they're going to take the risks. They're going to bet big.
You know what, Father? I had a just weird realization while we were talking about it, that's kind of how Burnham has captained sometimes, is she'll take a big risk, but she has the skill to pull it off. They are an interesting sort of outlaw reflection of her on that.
I liked Action Colbert having to get scrappy with Maul. I thought that was, like, so cool. I like that, oh, yeah, this guy will treat his patients, but sometimes he will fight his patients if he needs to. You know, we saw him fight Ash Tyler, the Klingon, Voke, right. Way back in season 2. He's like, oh, no, I just got resurrected, and I'm going to beat the shit out of the guy who killed me. So I like that.
He keeps getting in over his head in these things, but he got some solid licks in. He was doing all right, you know. He actually stood toe to toe with her, for longer than most of the guards were doing.
I mean, she took down 3 Federation security people, including Nahn, who's supposed to be like this big badass. So Colbert didn't really stand a chance, but good for him for trying.
I was watching Rachel and Aaron and their guests on the
our first reaction stream last night.
And somebody on there, they were having a little bit of fun talking about the very sculpted physique of Colbert, of Wilson Cruz, and saying, listen, you know, I'm sorry, but those muscles are for show. And he's like, and I was like, but as within the fiction, he's got some moves. He's got some Starfleet training. I think he knows a little bit more than the average dude.
Yeah, Wilson Cruz is like 10, 15 years older than me. I wouldn't want to get in a fight with him. He looks like he can throw down.
Yeah. How did you feel about Nahn, who we do know is quite a badass? Nahn was not able to even stop Maul.
I like Maul more than Nahn, so I root for Maul, I guess.
Same here. And you know, honestly, I think every once in a while, they did it way too often with Worf. But every once in a while, you have somebody take out the biggest badass in the room to remind yourself that this bad guy is a threat. They know what they can handle themselves.
Yeah, TNG and, Worf was there to get beat up.
Yeah, and because it's not something that they're always doing on Discovery, I think it's reasonable.
So when the Primarch comes on board and Tarina was able to translate his or was able to understand his weird brain voice without translation. I thought that was, like, kind of cool when she's like, oh, no, what he actually said was that he doesn't have the need to speak with insignificant awkworms. And then, like, when the Primarch kind of gives that kind of, like, what the hell look, which is cool when you can show that with, like, just a faceless helmet. But then it cuts back to Rainer, and he kind of gets, like, a little smirk. You know, Dave, you pointed out, like, oh, yeah, when Rainer smiles, it's kind of a fun moment. And I saw that here. It's like, oh, that's probably, like, the first time Rainer ever saw someone, you know, kind of make, like, the Breen gawk or, like, take a step back or something. So,
yeah.
Tarina impressed Rainer. I like that.
The last thing he was expecting, like, he was thinking the only thing the Breen respect is force. He didn't have the notion really even floating around as a possibility that you could maybe outmaneuver them with some, a little bit of psyops, you know, psychological warfare kind of stuff, where, or just politicking, you know. Yeah, she just undermined him by having more knowledge than he expected. Good power move from Tarina.
And I thought that the Breen, I don't know, the diplomatic envoy or whatever you want to call, like they look like pretty intimidating. Like it looks like he just like showed up with like a bunch of like soldiers, a bunch of like royal guards. Like they show up like, okay, we can like beat the shit out of you, you know, puny humans and Vulcans, you know, standing over like we're here to like throw down. You know, they go into a meeting, they go into like a diplomacy meeting with like they're geared to go into battle. And I think that I just assume that the Primarch kind of has to like put on like a show in front of his men, you know, like, watch, I'm gonna like call these guys awkworms to their face. So like when someone can like actually hear you say that and then call you out on it, it is probably not the look that you were hoping for.
Yeah. Throughout this, they come up with several points where they undermine his authority in such a way that he kind of has to sort of acknowledge it. It's pretty good stuff.
As we're talking about these Breen scenes, I think that the reason why I like Rune is just because he is just kind of this, he's not really a character, he's not a person, he's just kind of this political entity. He's just like, I am just whatever I need to be to get on the throne. If I need to be a guy who's so concerned about my nephew's life, then I'll be that guy. If I need to be a guy who's like, oh, I'm going to get revenge for my dead nephew, then I'll be that guy. If I need to be the guy who's like all concerned about like an Araga and like there's no way you can't negotiate, only blood can pay back an Araga, I'll be that guy. But oh, you have this progenitor tech? Well, okay, maybe I'll be the guy who forgives the Araga and in return receiving progenitor tech. So it kind of works. Actually, I don't know, maybe I'm just trying to like make like a defense for this lame faceless villain, but it kind of works for him to be this faceless villain who's not much of a fully realized character.
I've occasionally seen characters like that who are like really sort of desperate types where I kind of end up liking them because they're trying so hard. This is such a random reference, but the Wachowski sister movie Bound, Joe Pantoliano plays he's like the bad guy in it. They're trying to kind of get out from under his shadow in this noir. And yet throughout the whole thing, he's so desperate to make his like money laundering thing work that I kind of build up a sort of respect. And like, I'm like, I kind of almost want him to win at times or just in a moment, even though he is a terrible, violent person.
Yeah. You kind of can't help but root for him sometimes.
You know, here's the thing is like, we're used to having some sympathy for villains, you know, because like, oh, there's a Klingon villain that's a bad dude but honorable, or you know, certainly Mark Leonard in Balance of Terror, and that kind of thing. I wouldn't have minded seeing that from Rune when he says that he's like, later on Michael calls him out and she's like, you never gave a shit about Araga anyway, you know, you just want power. And I was like, oh yeah, she's quite right. And this is, you know, this is the central motivator for most of the problems that we face. I think it would have been like, if we had seen that there had been like, he's like, I, you know, I wanted my nephew to rise to the occasion. I had hoped I could mold him and, you know, into a person. And, you know, maybe if he had said like, oh, and I failed in that, but I won't fail to take the throne. But, you know, if we had seen that there was some connection to Locke beyond just a pawn, I think I would have liked to have gotten a touch of dimensionality to him like that.
I guess I'm thinking of like these people, these operatives like this in real life, you know, when you have like politicians who will like write a book where they brag about shooting a dog, and then like they'll go do like media interviews or where they try to like tell like a completely different story. It's just like people are just like so fake and insincere. I'm like, how the hell can like your kids like believe you when you look at them and say I love you? It's like you go on TV and put on like such a like a fake performance all the time. Like, how can like your loved ones trust you that you right. love them, you know? And it's like I'm thinking of like that level of deranged mentality of just like, I'll just be whatever it takes to win and stay in power, it's real
to me. It's galling to see. And, you know, actually, I'd love it if, like, I get the impression that a lot, that maybe he's not that unique among the Breen, that, you know, obviously the Breen that took over Raynor's world was a terrible person, too. But I think it'd be interesting if, like, his lack of at least some Breen values, that he was so mutable on his values, if that made him politically weak, and so the other Primarchs turn on him in the end, or they see him as an embarrassing liability and they bring him down. Like, that'd be a dope ass move to see Burnham pull.
That's interesting. I do have some predictions and speculation I might get into in a moment, but not so much Breen politics, but well, no, I do have like a Breen politic theory. I'll wait before we get into that though. Let's before we talk about the ending and the big death scene, let's do the B story stuff. We have the clue investigation that involved Stamets bringing in Tilly to work with Adira, and then also the Stamets and book stuff. But I kind of liked the it made me nervous as hell when I watched it, because I'm like, they're going to look so dumb if Maul and Locke steal this little library card from Stamets. And he's like running around the ship, waving it around like, this is the single most important prop that any character could be holding right now. And here's the camera doing a close up on it. And wouldn't it be dumb if the bad guys stole? I mean, like, he doesn't say that part, but I was thinking it. But I kind of liked his manipulation of Tilly. Like, oh, come on, your cadets are going to be safe at Fed HQ, right? Let me go tell Adira that you're going to help out. I was like, okay. That's some realistic manipulation, I think, when you're trying to recruit someone. Can I tell Adira? I think he says, can I let Adira know you're on your way to help?
I think he's mostly right here, but I felt like he was like the embattled school teacher who was like, could y'all just please do your homework? Just please. Like, I sort of felt for him here. But yeah, she was, I think, reasonably reacting emotionally. She wanted to be with the students who she's formed a bond with. Would have been nice to have seen a little bit more of that in the season, so we bought into it a little bit more. But I buy Tilly making that kind of bond.
When they said that that book that it's Dr. Marina Derricks, our Betazoid scientist, wrote the book The Labyrinths of the Mind. It came out in 2371. As soon as I heard the year 2371, my Star Trek brain went, ah, Voyager season 1, Deep Space 9 season 3. That's when the book was published. So,
oh right.
I don't know if that'll have any relevance in the next episode when I assume we go to the library and find out more about the book. But yeah, Reno as the person with the book knowledge. I was thinking that that library. I was kind of hoping that we would actually be going to Beta Zed and not this roaming library. Although I'm curious. The roaming library does sound cool. I'm curious to see what they do to show that off. There was some library looking stuff in the trailers for the season, but I think there's going to be a lot more to it than what we saw there.
You know, the weird thing to me is libraries are usually meant to be places you can find, like an archive or something like that, where
she said it's like more of a bank than a library. It's like a bank, okay. But it's for storing knowledge and not money.
So they did mention that. Okay, yeah. Don't want to get that place.
But like even banks, you know, like you can put in like the bank in your GPS and get like instructions on how to like drive to the bank to rob. You know, it's like they're typically not secret either.
This is the Space Library of Alexandria, and it needs to be protected.
Yeah, I guess there's reasons that you want to have a... I don't know, Dave, maybe there are secret libraries that where, like, we never know their location so that they can store all the information, so that we don't have another Alexandria incident.
I mean, it's all digital now. It's just, we're just gonna watch out for EMPs.
There's gonna be a big EMP eventually, right? Like, the law averages, you know, like, how many hundreds of years? Like, there's gonna be one go off eventually, so...
That's true. Yeah, we better keep some physical stuff around just in case.
I'll stop my slippery slope before it goes too far. But
you know, I've been wondering, like, Locke and Maul generally are trying to follow them to most of the places they go to. Are these, theoretically, if they were both around, are they going to go terrorize this poor library too? I guess not. They don't have the clue right now.
But that's gonna be the concern in the next episode, I think. The Breen have no idea where to go. Maul doesn't know where to go. But as soon as Disco jumps to that library, they're going to be on their ass there. So the next episode, the hunt for that final clue, they're going to be like, we got to find this shit fast because the Breen are on their way to us. And, you know, Maul just thinks Locke died and is like, she's going to do everything in her power to get the progenitor tech. And she has like that Primarch behind her and like all of his Breen resources, and we know how crazy she's gonna. So I'm actually like really excited about like the next episode about like going to this library.
I just hope that they get what they're what ones the idea would at least be get what they have and then tell the library to go park somewhere else, anywhere like really good and secretive, go hide in the garage. Because a Breen dreadnought is not what you want parking in the library parking lot.
I did like some of Reno's like past jobs, like in addition to smuggling books, she was a VIP shuttle pilot, a deep mercury welder. That's cool. You know, there's planets with like mercury ocean, so there's deep mercury welders. What a cool little Star Trek blue collar job to have. The bartending, seven of limes is okay. They will have drinks in the future named after the Enterprise. There's probably a Picard drink and a Kirk drink and a Pike drink, but yeah, seven of nine, captain of Enterprise G has a drink named after her.
Yeah,
I thought that when she said that she used to work for what did she say exactly? I used to move hard to find folios for a shady antiquarian archivist. I did wonder, are they going to tie that into Palea? Like, did Palea and Reno know each other? But I don't think so. I think Palea in the 23rd century, she wasn't in her, like, weird archivist phase that she was in the 21st century. She was more of, like, she's just, like, Starfleet engineer.
Yeah. But
I don't know. Maybe Palea taught Reno at the academy. I don't know. Maybe that's how, like, Reno got recruited into Starfleet was through Palea. I don't know.
Yeah, those are all possibilities.
Possible story.
If they wanted to connect those dots, yeah. But if nothing else, I did think it was just fun to... I felt it fit Reno that she, you know, had this kind of some sort of an aimless periods.
I think I laughed at Adira, like, oh, it sounds like you got around. I mean, I don't mean like that. And then Reno being like, no, like that.
Yes.
The book empathy thing on the library card, that seemed a little odd that Betazoids can telepath onto a piece of metal, some type of psionic signature, and then they can telepath the same type of psionic signature onto a physical place. And even if that physical place moves to other physical places, the metal card will still have a connection to it. But I guess you can do that.
Yeah, it'd probably be worth mentioning that's like, you know, just a line like, well, this is a pretty rare gift among Betazoids, but, you know, the most powerful Omega-level empaths can do it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we don't know if it is like that Dr. Marina Betazoid. It could have been like someone else, like, oh, this is so important to hide the progenitor tech. I'll have to go get, you know, some good telepath to do this for me.
Yeah. That said, I do like, you know, when Book gets to use his powers and stuff.
Yeah.
I had a hard time buying that the immediate knowledge of Maul running around loose on the ship, that he could stop even, that he would just not go right out that door. that was a stretch.
Yeah, I didn't really like think about that until now, but I agree. I think that, because they do kind of like make a big deal about it. Like, Stamets is even like, well, just wait, just figure out this card real quick and then go find her. But yeah, you'd think he'd be like a little bit more urgent.
If it was a more general thing, like, well, she's escaped and I want to get on tracking her coordinates, I can understand him pausing there. But it's like, he knows she's loose on the ship and they're like, is being probably hunted. So anyway. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the recapture of Maul, the death of Locke, and the ending of the episode. I thought it was funny when Nan and Book are going down the corridor, and the first thing we see is someone just standing there with their hands up before the camera pans over and shows Maul holding a phaser at that crew member. I thought it was funny that just, oh, we know we found Maul because we see someone clearly being held hostage before
like
we see who's holding them.
I think it's one of those slightly realistic bits of weirdness that I think I kind of like it.
I liked a lot of the camera work. I think that John Dudkowski did a good job directing this. And like when Maul made her escape and you got like the stylized, I know some people like get tired of the spinny camera stuff, but I feel like they've made it much more tame in the later seasons of Disco. But like the spinny camera stuff when Maul froze her handcuffs and beat up those dudes to escape sickbay, I thought that all was real exciting and dynamic.
There was a real showy camera shot earlier that, you know, where the camera drifted down through like one of the viewports right to watch Burnham talking, you know, in the hallway. I think maybe talking to Nan. I can't quite remember. But I was enjoying it. I mean, it is part of Discovery's identity. We may all find it a little bit much sometimes, but it's part of the identity.
Book was able to talk Maul into standing down and convinced her to surrender and come back to sickbay because the love of your life is about to die. Y'all messed up. Y'all were too risky too much. And now you're going to lose Locke.
Was it that kind of got Nan's respect? Like, oh, okay, I guess you weren't just bullshitting about your connection to her.
Yeah, it was either that or like right before that. But Nan does seem to forgive Book and accept that he's on the up and up. He's one of the good guys. So that was good. When Locke actually does die in front of Maul, and when she's crying, like, no, this is not how our story ends, and just I don't know, like the Breen standing there, the way that was shot, the way that Colber and Burnham look like, you know, so sad, but also like trying to like show respect. And I don't know. I was really crushed by it. I bought into their love story so much more than I thought I would. And it hurt. I wasn't expecting it.
That was one of those moments that didn't quite get to me. I wanted it to, but I think sort of an awareness that the story wasn't ending there kept me from kind of like quite feeling the feels.
Oh, you were the opposite of me. I was like thinking like that was going to be the end of the episode. It was going to end on that.
Yeah, I think I knew that it was. I think I had some awareness that it was a little ways, had a little ways to go. I'll say this always, that the actress who plays Maul, Eve Harlow, is always really good at selling that connection. She has a sort of desperate love to her, you know, like she's really gone through a lot, and it's the one tether she's got, and she, you know, it's going to break her when she loses it. And, you know, well, we're about to find out that they had, like, gotten secretly married and stuff. And so, yeah, I think she always does a good job in these scenes.
Yeah, like her denial when she's like, this isn't how her story ends, was, like, not wanting to accept it. You immediately see how big of a piece of shit Primarch Rune is when he's when he says intention is nothing, outcome is everything. All he's concerned about is how can I spin these events into securing my power. And it's like, I love that they had him say those words. Intention is nothing, outcome is everything. You just killed the Scion. You just killed him. You know, Burnham's like, what are you talking about? Like, he died from, you know, he gave himself that overdose. But he says intention is nothing, outcome is everything. All that matters is what people are going to believe. You know, the way that I spin it. And when the Breen are actually like going to leave and go back to the Dreadnought and attack the HQ, I thought it was funny when like Vance kind of does like, he does like this really like animated thing, like waving his arms, like, no, like, you were just talking, you were commenting Oded Fear a second ago. I remember seeing him at Star Trek Las Vegas a couple years ago and how, in real life, he's not like this cool, suave, confident admiral. He's kind of like a goofy dad. He's like an awkward, goofy dad. He's like nothing like a, like any character I've ever seen him play. So he kind of like, that. He kind of turned to like his like goofy, cause he has like these real like animated, you know, gestures, like waving his arms around like that. And he's kind of like this tall, skinny guy with like these long arms and long legs. So it was like, oh man, this guy could probably do like a lot of great physical comedy.
You know, Father, they don't mention this, but I feel like if psychologically why he kind of was like off this episode and why he would do things like that. I think the last time he had a... Didn't Osira pull right up to Starfleet HQ? Yeah. This poor guy is having PTSD about that.
This episode reminded me a lot of when Osira came to HQ and they had kind of their diplomatic talk between Osira and Vance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's like, the Federation is just getting stable, just starting to get there, and these stupid outlaws and this, you know, Red Directive and stuff are gonna... could end it all right today.
But when all of the Starfleet ships show up to help support the Disco and the HQ fight the Breen, it did feel like, oh, wow, it almost feels like the Battle of the Binary Star is all over again. And it, to me, that added to the tension because it's like, I don't want this to turn out the way that that did and, you know, lead to something as devastational as the Klingon War. Mm-hmm. But I also think it's more of that theme. I don't know how much of this is intentional. But that recurring theme I keep bringing up of Discovery Season 5 mirroring Season 1 and kind of the entire show having this mirror motif to it. You know, the three times we go to the mirror universe are in Season 1, Season 5, we kind of got in the mirror universe and mirrors. And then, like, in Season 3, when Giorgio went back for a little bit, so you kind of have, like, that symmetry of, like, the middle point and then the two bookends.
Yeah.
You also have... Burnham being recruited by Lorca, mirrored in Season 5 by Rayner being recruited by Burnham. And then, you know, all that Breen stuff with Rayner matching the Klingon stuff with Burnham in Season 1. I don't know. I think a lot of that had to be on purpose.
I think so. I think, you know, that you sort of, you build structures, I think, when you have a chance as writers and in writing rooms. And... You know, it may not be evident, but I think you might be looking like, you might find moments and pull them together or realize, oh, this thematic, if we want, we can make it echo that Season 1 thematic. So, yeah, that's kind of cool. And it's one of those things where it's like, it's kind of wild that it should be the case because they didn't know it was the final season, that they should have something that echoes the first season in particular.
But when Maul does that reveal of like, look, we have our secret Breen marriage tattoos, and where he goes, I go, and you have to take me back with you, and I'll help you find the progenitor tech. I was really shocked by that moment, but I loved how it's kind of like soap opera trash of like, oh no, we were secretly married all along. But I like those big dramatic reveals. I bought into that. But what do you think about it?
You know, that's, Father, you've made me now want to see, in the style of one of those ads for a telenovela, I want to see this season of Star Trek described with that kind of, the big announcer voice and stuff like that, and just like, the big dramatic moments.
Yes, the recaps, I want them to have, like, the big melodramatic Spanish dude saying all of that.
Sabado.
Yeah.
I agree. Let's if some fan could get on that, that'd be amazing. To me, it like their love was already evident. That didn't particularly mean anything other than their crazy young lovers who got hitched too early. Because for all I know, by the way, although I believe it's true love right now, they also both wanted to get out of where they were. And like, could they last a year? You know, if they had a year or two of peace, would they still be together, or would they like, you know, get to know each other better and find that, oh, when you're not on the run, it's maybe they're not right for each other. But as we know them right now in the moment, yeah, we already knew that they had true love. So that was just, well, it meant everything to the Breen. You know, it had been it clearly like gave some leverage and meant that she now had like sort of marital ties to the Scion.
And how quickly the Primarch changes his tune when he's like, oh, you're an abomination. Wait, oh yeah, of course you can come with us.
Yeah. By the way, like, if things should happen to end up okay for Locke and Maul, are we going to see Trek fans maybe occasionally getting those when they get married?
Oh, that's a fun idea. Yeah, maybe.
I mean, I think you'd have to know that things turn out okay. It's this, like, the, you know, don't want to name your kid Daenerys because she's so cool in the early seasons, only to get to the final season of Game of Thrones. You know, you got to see how it plays out first.
Good point.
I liked her last gambit, you know, that sort of, okay, I've got some information for you, and it's the one thing I've got right now, and so I'm going to reveal the marriage, I'm going to reveal the progenitor's tech, fuck it all, because what else, what does she have to lose at that point?
I was so mad the first time I watched this, when they have Maul in that soundproof force field room, like in Denis Villeneuve's Dune, and they're having the debate about what to do with her, and Book is like, no, we can't just, like, turn her over, like, the Breen will kill her as soon as they get what they want. I was kind of, like, on Book's side. I was like, like, you can't do that, like, you can't put her in danger. To be fair, like, Maul is going on her own accord, like, that is what she wants to do, but I get, like, the Book instinct of, like, she's not thinking straight. Her husband just died. Like, please, like, don't let her do this. It's not going to work out well for her. But, you know, Tarina has got to be the Vulcan logic, the good of the many. And so, you know, Vulcans can be cold. That's that's something that Star Trek's made clear from day one. So, but I'm glad that the plan, like, didn't come from Saru. I'm glad that it came from Tarina, that Tarina's here to kind of be the ambassador of the episode, because I didn't want that to come from someone I like as much as Saru, because I don't know, I like Maul, like, I'm worried about her. I don't want her to get killed by the Breen.
Yeah, how many episodes do we have left, Fathery?
Just three.
Three, okay, three.
So we're going to have, like, one normal episode to get the final clue, and then a two-part series finale.
I'm wondering if there's any chance that Roon will find something. I wondered when he saw them together, when he saw their love, if he would find that some part of him was moved by it. They didn't go to that place. And I feel like if he didn't feel it in that moment, he's not going to feel it. But I do wonder if, like, having her as his prisoner, I guess, that if he might change his mind a little bit about what he thinks about her. I don't know. He doesn't seem to have it in him right now. He seems like just a schmuck.
I like that at this exciting time in the season, when I'm pretty sure I'm going to get my wish of Book and Burnham getting back together. They've both confessed that they still have romantic feelings for the other, not to each other, but to the audience. I think it's going to happen, but it's exciting to me now that we got this new conflict between them, of, like, Book kind of being, you know, upset about Burnham going along with this.
That felt a little previous season to me, you know? So, it was just a line, but when he's like, this is wrong, Michael, I was like, I had a sudden flashback to that season, and a memory that I don't like too much when they're contrived apart.
I didn't think it was contrived. I agree. I understood her reasoning, and I understood his reasoning, so that's why, yeah, I liked it.
Just half an hour earlier, he had been like, I'll pause and solve a riddle rather than save her, so maybe that's why I was a little inclined to judge him harshly. But yes, no, of course he's got the emotional attachment, and Tarina had to be the one to say there's more good in letting her, or more good possibilities in letting her go.
Yeah, there's less to lose,
or less basically to lose. Yeah, it's kind of what's the least bad, least worst option is kind of the situation they were in. But yeah, I did like that they had to. They were in a lot of very compromising situations, and they did, you know, they kept Starfleet HQ did not get destroyed. A war did not happen.
But we always talk about like these moral quandaries, and that would have been hard. That would have been a hard decision for me to make there, like in the spot of like, okay, I'm gonna like turn over this prisoner to the Breen. But
yeah, no, that's it. Feels, you know, it feels dishonorable, and you know, just it does feel wrong. But that is I think the harsh side of politics that I occasionally, you know, Discovery does like to sometimes challenge their characters to have to make some tough decisions.
And it felt a little Deep Space Nine to me. It felt a little bit like DS9 was the first Trek show to go into that territory a lot. To go into the territory of, you know, what if the Federation encountered an adversary that you couldn't reason with? Like they would just refuse. No, we're going to make you fight a war. You know, stuff like that. You know, when the traditional like convenient answers. Well, what about like when you can't get one of those? You know, then what do you do? Mm-hmm. And yeah, I don't know if I was in command. I mean, I guess I would hope to like not be in command. I would want to only be like a first officer and not a captain ever, because of like this very reason of like I wouldn't want to have to make that call of like turning Maul over to the Breen.
Right.
But it is the final, I guess, clue we now know is in the Badlands, and we are off to one last, I guess, final standalone episode next week. Our final, I think it's going to be a lot of tension, because like I said, you know, they're probably going to be in a hurry with a ticking clock of like the Breen are going to, you know, Maul is going to show up with a squadron of Breen to come, you know, steal whatever we're trying to acquire at any minute. So we need to haul ass and get this done. But I think that'll be like our last normal episode, and then part one of the finale is directed, they're not titling it as like a two-parter, but I think it'll play out that way. Part one's directed by Jonathan Frakes, and then I think it's a Toon Day on the finale, but I think they'll have a big two-parter like they've done with every season. So
were all the clues that they've been to, I don't know that they've said it explicitly, but were they all in the Alpha Quadrant?
I guess they haven't said exactly, but I'm under the impression that, yeah, they've been in the Alpha Beta Quadrant.
You know, if it was somewhere like really way
low, it has been
out,
it has to all be in the Alpha Beta Quadrants because of the 24th
people
century.
Without
spore, yeah
without spore drives have been getting there.
This was all done during the Dominion War, so it was just Romulans and Federation people just doing normal like the TNG Deep Space Nine neighborhoods.
Right, we have to hide the Easter eggs around the house. We can't go to the other neighborhoods.
Yeah, that actually does make sense. But it would have been like a fun, you know, excuse to like get to the Gamma Quadrant or Delta Quadrant.
Yeah, it's just that like the Spore Drive people could get there no problem. For Locke and Maul, they'd be like, we gotta go where?
But the other people's ships can still get across the galaxy. Just it's not as instant as Disco.
Right.
I think we don't know exactly how long it takes to go from like one end to the other end, but I assume it'd just be like weeks.
Yeah, they may even have like uncovered some other wormholes since last we knew. It's,
yeah,
you know,
we know that they're using like the Borg transwarp corridors and all kinds of stuff. I do have some predictions, I think, before the end of the show. I don't tend to forecast too much, but you know, we talk a lot about like not having any idea where Maul and Locke are going and how long Locke will stay dead. And you know, Maul seems to be, her objective must be to acquire the progenitor tech, use it to bring Locke back to life. So that is a possibility. I don't know how likely that is, but I'm so concerned. I think there's gonna be like a Romeo and Juliet type tragedy here. I don't think they're both gonna make it out. I don't know if we're gonna get a happy ending. I think either Maul or Locke, or maybe both, will be permanently dead by the end of the season. So I wonder what if part of like Maul's attempt to bring Locke back, what if that results in her death? And so we end the show with resurrected Locke. What if he becomes like this like cold-hearted like Breen Emperor, and then Emperor Locke, ruler of the Breen? He's like the big scary, he becomes like the new like Borg queen, you know, he's like the new like Gold Dukat. He's like the new like scary person we all have to be worried about in the Star Trek Academy show that they're going to do in the coming years, or you know, whatever. Maybe else takes place in the 32nd century. Like
that would be a dark ending, and I kind of don't see them going that dark. I also, by the way, I don't think that Locke, he has not built up the skills to be that.
But the death of Maul might be what drives him to that.
Right. He just doesn't have, like, he doesn't have political manipulation skills and that kind of thing yet. Could he get into it? Yeah, potentially so. Right now he's good at being a courier.
But right now he's good at being a corpse, because he's...
That's messed up.
But he might get uncorpsified. You know, some Maul's going to try to uncorpsify him. We know that.
That would be the very Romeo and Juliet thing to do, which is, you know, that, like, awake only to find her dead.
Or maybe Maul is pregnant, and then her offspring would be the new Scion, right? So maybe she acquires the throne.
Mm.
Her child would be, like, the new heir. I mean, I don't even know if Breen can, you know, reproduce with humans, but you know, Star Trek might make it possible. They've had to go to the doctor to be like, hey, let's combine our Klingon and Vulcan DNA to make a baby or whatever. You know, sometimes they do that. Sometimes you don't have to go to the doctor for it, though. Like, sometimes accidents happen, and sometimes it's like, oh, no, like, we had to, like, engineer our offspring.
Sure, they've got some options, I would imagine, in the 32nd century. But, yeah, I don't know what would happen then. I feel like she, if she wanted to be on the throne, she could be, or she would, or she'd be on the run forever because they'd be after that baby forever.
I don't think that Roon is going to be the ruler of the Breen at the end of the show, and I don't think both Maul and Locke will be alive, but maybe one of them. But I could be wrong. Maybe that they will, you know, somehow escape and live happily ever after. I don't think so, though.
Do you have predictions specifically, Fathery? Any other ones?
Well, I know that you think that Owo and Detmer might come back on the ISS Enterprise at some point.
Right. Were they headed back to Starfleet HQ? Like, in other words, were they in a dock?
They said they were
somewhere?
Taking it to storage, but we don't know.
Oh, okay.
They might have gone to that Starfleet Museum if it didn't blow
Maybe
up during
so.
The burn. It might have blown up during the burn, for all we know. But what if it comes back, and when it shows up, it has, like, a 32nd century refit, like they did to the Discovery when it went from 23rd century to 32nd century, and we get to see a 23rd century constitution with detached nacelles and all kinds of, like, cool Tron lighting on it? I think that might look dumb, but it might look really awesome.
Although I like the idea, I think there just has not been the time for that. There's been, like, what, maybe a few weeks best? There's no way they can do a ship refit that fast.
No, that doesn't take programmable matter that long. It probably takes it, like, 4 hours, and you got, like,
oh, like
a brand
new
ship.
yeah, and but I was thinking, like, you know, yes, they've got this big-ass starship. You know, it's a Chekhov's gun kind of thing. Why bring that back if you're not going to do something with it? They didn't have to bring the whole thing back, but they made a plot point of it. But, yeah, its weapons are not going to, like, be carving up a Breen ship. The one thing I was thinking that they could do is ram that shit. It's still got, like, the antimatter core and all that stuff, so... I'm gonna just, that's my dark horse theory, is Owo and Detmer come as a cavalry at some point, and they ram that shit into a Breen vessel, the Dreadnought.
Mm-hmm.
You could do that with other ships, but this one has the advantage of not having a crew on it and being a nice empty ship.
I think it'd be cool if they made it a functional ship in the fleet, though, since we don't know if there is a USS Enterprise somewhere. Maybe this can be, like, the new Enterprise, and they can renumber it NCC-1701X. I think it'd be cool if, like, we're on letter X now in the 32nd century. That's also kind of stupid and juvenile, but I don't... That's like Elon Musk, like, I'm just going to name the website X, but that's kind of... Hey, it worked for, like, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, so...
Maybe they should have a backwards letter because it's from the mirror universe.
But a backwards X is still an X, so it would be backwards.
A backwards A is also still an A. There's all kinds of letters that they could backwards.
Yeah.
That would be terrible. Do not do the mirror letters. Beyond that, though, yeah, I don't have any, like, strong predictions about other stuff going on. I think you're right. I think that Locke will probably get resurrected, but that there will be some price to be paid, and it could end up Shakespeare sad. Except that I think Discovery, even if they don't know it's a finale, I think they don't want to, like, end on the sour note, and they don't want to say kind of thematically love is doomed and, you know, young lovers, you have no chance in a harsh world. So I think they're going to somehow...
Do you think Maul and Locke will get somehow end on a win? Like,
I think they will end on a win. There may be a asterisk next to that. There may be some sadness. You know, it's like, oh, it can revive him, but he won't be back for 20 years. Even their technology can't just instantly revive. Yeah, you know, something like that. We'll see.
And the only other theory I guess I got that I want to get out on the record, just in case it does happen, I don't think this is likely. But, you know, in the first episode, when they mentioned the Breen for the first time, they also mentioned the Tholians in, like, that same sentence. So what if, I don't know, the next episode, the Tholians will show up out of nowhere and just kick the shit out of the Breen, and they're like, oh, you're actually dealing with the Tholians the rest of the season.
They would have the chance of having a little bit more depth.
But they would probably just be like weird, like CGI creatures that aren't really like realized characters, instead of just stuntmen in helmets. But
yeah, no, I think that is the case. I think we're gonna it's gonna be all Breen all the time.
Well, it's Breen a long road getting to it, but we're finally getting some substance with the Breen, some mysteries revealed. So I'm liking it more than I thought I would. I was kind of nervous about them getting into that, but I love what they're showing me so far. So I've never been a more Breen fan than I am now.
I would just like a little bit deeper lore on their culture. Right now, it's a little too much early era kind of Klingon, you know, kind of or movie style, I guess I'd say. So I want a little bit more. I like that they're doing it, though. I think that that was a good call.
Well, let's get into the Gorn egg section of the show. This is where we like to talk about the Easter eggs, in-jokes, and continuity connections we found within the episode we thought were worth mentioning. This is a weird-as-hell deep-cut reference that I haven't heard anyone else talk about other than me. I guess because it's so weird no one else caught it. But near the beginning of the episode, Nan says that Maul is as fierce as a Satakru cat. That was a creature from a 6-page Star Trek comic that was in a magazine in 2009 to promote Star Trek 09. It's written by Alex Kurtzman and Bob Orsi, and it was illustrated by Paul Pope. Very good comic book artist.
I was just about to say that looks like Paul Pope's art, but as far I never knew he did anything with him, and that's an artist I've followed at times, even though it turns out as a person he's kind of a piece of shit.
Yeah, well, there is a Satakru cat that looks a lot like a Vulcan Lamatra. It's like the same thing, except Alex Kurtzman and Bob Orsi wanted to call it a Satakru instead. So that's what they put in the comic.
That's wild. I had not looked into that at all, and I was just like, oh, I think they just made up something right then and there on the spot.
Yeah. No, you got to go to Memory Beta to learn about this stuff. It's it's beta canon, not alpha canon, which I think is kind of a weird terminology. Like, I think it's either canon or it's not canon, you know? It's like, but it is what it is.
The way these mega franchises work, where they have core material like the movies and then kind of supporting material like the books, I think there's room for the terminology. Yeah.
Rayner has some fun Deep Space Nine references in this episode. He talks about in the briefing near the beginning of the episode, when they're first preparing for the arrival of the Dreadnought, he's talking about, what if we used Thuron fields and Duranium shadows to make it look like we're more heavily armed than we are? That was Kira's trick in the very first episode of Deep Space Nine, Emissary, when they were trying to bluff to the Cardassians about, like, oh, we actually have, like, a bunch of torpedoes and stuff, even though they didn't. Mm-hmm. And then Rayner had another one when he says, never turn your back on a Breen, which I thought was really cool when Tarina got on him immediately about the xenophobia, because that is a catchphrase that comes from her world. That is a Romulan saying, never turn your back on a Breen.
Right, right.
So she was like, no, you're not going to do any Vulcanoid xenophobia. Like, no, I'm gonna get in front of that right now and put a stop to that. I like that. Maybe when people see like their culture being used in a bigoted way like that, maybe take a little responsibility on it.
Yeah.
But that is a cool moment from the episode By Inferno's Light, when they had that sick Breen in the Dominion prison. It was part of, you know, when the Breen were mysterious, we didn't know anything about them. But there was like that one prisoner, the Breen, and he just kept laying there on the cot. And then he never got up or did anything. And then when they're dealing with the Jem'Hadar, when they needed him most, the Breen stood up and shot the Jem'Hadar. And then in turn was shot and vaporized by another Jem'Hadar. But that was when the Romulan in that episode said, never turn your back on a Breen.
That's pretty cool.
And then the Betazoid symbol on the library card got a lot of screen time in this episode. But that's really cool. I saw Jörg Hillebrand on Twitter point out that the original logo that's based on was designed by a Star Trek fan, David Billick, for a fan-based gaming mod, Birth of the Federation. So I think that's cool. Like, that's like a canonical thing. The other shows have used that, but we saw it a lot in this episode, and how cool for David Billick, who designed that.
Mm-hmm.
Rayner also mentions that Primarch T'Hil named her ship after a Tal Ceti serpent. Tal Ceti is a star system in Star Trek that gets mentioned a lot. Like, the Traveler came from there. They say it a lot in the original series. They say it a lot in TNG. They say it a lot all over the place. It's like, if it ain't Rigel, it's probably Tal Ceti. I just think it's cool whenever they mention it.
Father, you know how in Marvel Comics, like, all the superheroes kind of are in New York because that's where the writers were originally? It feels like that's what Rigel and Tau Ceti are. Those are like those are the moving and shaking places.
Yeah, that's where the cool hip people are. When Maul is cornered by Nan and Book when they recapture her, she doesn't believe their claims that Locke is dying. And she says, nice try. Why don't you try to sell me a goat farm on Bopak 3 while you're at it? This is another good Deep Space Nine reference. Bopak 3 was the episode, was the planet that the episode Hippocratic Oath took place on, when Julian tried to cure the Jem'Hadar of their Ketracel White addiction, but he couldn't. So
that's pretty cool. That's a pretty deep cut.
This one actually kind of bugs me just a little bit. This is a very fanboy nitpick, but Locke was on a tricordrazine is what he OD'd on. Tricordrazine has been mentioned in Star Trek a lot, like going back to TNG. You know, in the original series, they had cordrazine. You know, tricky stuff, that cordrazine. You know, the McCoy says at one point, but then eventually they get tricordrazine. I just feel like by the 32nd century, like, shouldn't we have quintocordrazine or quattrocordrazine at least, or, you know, something like that? Like do what you did with the trouble with triples grain, but do it with the cordrazine. Just my advice going anything, because like now we can never have those, like before, you know, in the 32nd century they're still using tricordrazine, so now like we know that like in the 28th 29th century they never figure out anything else.
Some programmable matter cordrazine.
Yeah. Maybe that's what the Academy kids will get into. And then last but not least, the location of the final clue. I'm disappointed I'm not getting to see Betazoid in the 32nd century, but I am going to get to see the Badlands in the 32nd century. But yeah, the Badlands from Deep Space Nine and Voyager both went there. But the big plasma storm place where whenever you need your characters to go somewhere, like, oh, here's a really inconvenient place for our ships to have to go. Then you send them to the Badlands. That's all I got, though.
You know, you could probably take down a dreadnought with you if you do the right maneuvers in the Badlands.
So. Oh, that would be... Maybe we'll have some cool ship combat stuff next week in the Badlands.
That'd be kind of dope.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll see some ship combat. There hasn't been any ship combat at all, other than a little bit, I guess, in the first episode when they're just chasing Maul and Locke's ship with and trying to like, nice. Lock on with a tractor beam.
Yeah, I could go for a little pew-pew, a little classic Trek dust-up in space.
Yeah, I think it'd be earned this time. As long as they don't get too crazy, sure. Don't get too gratuitous with it. But y'all have heard Dave and I talk about this episode for an hour and a half, so we would love some feedback. Let us know what you think about it. You can reply on YouTube. You can reply to my tweets or join the Text Trek Discord server. There's a link in the description wherever you're watching or listening to us. So click that link and come join the Discord and keep the conversation going over there and tell us what you think. Tell us all the things Dave and I said that were wrong. Or tell us all the things that we said that were correct, that we need to be recognized for being right on. We would love to hear it either way. In fact, we have some subspace transmissions that we got from last week's episode, Whistle Speak.
Yeah, let's start out with... we've got several from Discord here. First from a longtime listener, Joanne Robertson. She says, I thought Whistlespeak was a really good exploration of how we communicate when we find ourselves fundamentally opposed to ideas and approaches. I really love the way they used faith and culture as the primary lens and managed to avoid some of the paternalistic ethical smugness that we've seen in other examinations of faith. I think Halemno would be a great world to explore in a Star Trek book, and I hope someone does. You know, I often feel that way about a lot of Star Trek stuff, and I'm glad Joanne mentioned that there's, you know, this would make for cool, you know, for a writer to kind of go poking around and do the deep dive on it. Let's see. Also from Discord, we have parentheses I. I just watched this episode and I was amazed. I feel pretty comfortable saying that this episode is my favorite out of the entire Discovery series so far. It explored a new civilization on a new planet. It tackled issues like religion, social dynamics, spirituality, and living a life of meaning and purpose. It simultaneously had broad social and deeply personal themes to it. Episodes like this is what I was originally hoping that Discovery was going to be like from the very start of the series. It's a shame that it took the Discovery show this long to finally be able to make episodes like this, but hey, better late than never. That's interesting. I'm pleased to see, you know, people enjoying it, even though it was not a favorite for me, and not just enjoying it, but like one of their favorites. I kind of like to recontextualize Trek sometimes. I like hearing from, you know, some Eidic opinions. Let's see. Cassie Mack addresses you, Fathery, talking about the Mofungo that was made in the episode and says, "Dude, calm down. Colburn knew the Mofungo was replicated. That whole conversation was taken from his memory. Maybe it broke his heart when it originally happened, but 930 plus years later, it's become a comforting memory that he enjoys revisiting. Let the man grieve." And then just closing it out, over on Facebook, this more in line with me, I guess. Jay Stevens said, "The season was going so good until this episode." So we've got the full span of thoughts there.
Well, I love hearing back from our audience. So that's really cool. And I'm going to be eager to hear what people think about this episode and also what they think about next week's episode, Labyrinth. Like I said, like, this is our last like normal episode. Like, we have this and then we have like a 2-part series finale. So this final clue, this is kind of like the last, just kind of a normal standard Discovery outing. And showrunner Michelle Paradise says, "Oh, just an incredible, gorgeous location, incredible scope, and a singular journey for Burnham." So, some Labyrinths for Burnham, it sounds like.
Okay.
But looking forward to talking about that with you, Dave, Friday at 7 p.m. Central, live on YouTube. And folks can also listen to us wherever they get their podcasts. Until next time, as always, live long and prosper, y'all.
Listen to the Text Trek podcast through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or at text-trek.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/text-trek. And follow Fathery on Twitter at TXTrek. Please support us by liking our videos and subscribing to our channel on YouTube. Thank you and take care.